Jewish audio on Chabad.org.
So we're talking about the 10 special mitzvahs that the Rebbe chose in order to galvanize the Jewish people, to stimulate their Yiddishkeit. As the Rebbe once said, that there's a spark of faith, a spark of emunah. We call this colloquially the pintle yid, the dot, nuclear essence of Jewishness, that we are, we have a neshama. And no matter where a person goes and how a person behaves, ultimately, that dot, that spark, that nuclear essence can never, ever be extinguished. The question, of course, then is, how do we engage this spark? How do we get it to become from a latent potential? How do we make it into a reality? And the Rebbe believed that through a series of mitzvahs and a mitzvah campaign, we would be able to ignite the Jewish spark, and who knows where it can go from there. Who knows? Some people's whole lives turn inside out. Some people simply become much more committed than they were previously. And the truth is, as I said last week, it's an endless journey. It's a continuous journey. So we discussed previously the mitzvah of Taharas HaMashpacha. We talked about the mitzvah of family purity, which is a very rigorous and detailed and difficult and challenging observance. It's not simple at all. And we talked about the idea that it doesn't seem like much of a mivtza. It's not a campaign. It's not a cash and carry. It's not something quick. You hand somebody Shabbat candles. The Rebbe didn't make a mivtza. He didn't say, campaign, get everybody to keep Shabbos from the sunset to nightfall the next day. Of course, that's what the Rebbe wanted. That's what the Torah wants. That's what God wants. That's what a Jew is supposed to do. Okay, fine. But if you're going to go over to a person who is not really observant at all and say, listen, can I speak to you for a few minutes? Okay, sure. What would you like? I'd like you to stop everything. Don't do anything that you do in your regular, ordinary day. Instead, you go to shul and you're going to just read nice books and spend time with your family. Change your whole life every 6 days, okay? Every 6 days. The seventh day, be totally different. The person looks at you as if, you must be crazy. I just can't become a Shomer Shabbat like that. And very few people who have become Shomer Shabbat became Shomer Shabbat overnight. So where does it start? It starts with a spark. It starts with a beginning. And the Rebbe believed that the spark that could kindle Shabbos was the flames of the Shabbos candles. So Shabbat candles, that's a mitzvah. That's a campaign. Putting on tefillin with a Jewish man can spark something. And there are many stories of how one time putting on tefillin did spark something and did change things. And people became much more involved, much more engaged. It helped reveal the pintle yid. But Taharas HaMashpacha, living a life of ritual purity and observing the Torah's rigorous demands on when a husband and wife shouldn't be together seems like anything but campaign worthy. And yet the Rebbe did make a campaign out of it. And there are amazing stories of it being successful despite the fact that it's kind of counterintuitive that it should be. Nonetheless, this was something we talked about, something we described. And the mitzvah, the campaign we're going to talk about tonight, is the mitzvah which is called kosher. We could say keeping kosher, but the truth is that when the Rebbe spoke about it, almost always, he spoke about a kosher kitchen. Because you can't keep kosher if you don't have a kosher kitchen. And for most normal people who have the privilege of living somewhere, of actually having a place to live in, they will not only need a bed to sleep in, which is kind of important, you need to go to sleep, you also need to have a kitchen. So people can live without a living room, but they need to have a kitchen, you need to eat. There's very few people in this world who live without a kitchen. So if you're going to keep kosher, you need to have a kosher kitchen. And because you need to have a kosher kitchen, the Rebbe made this campaign of getting people involved in kosher, which meant also helping kosher the kitchens. In fact, the Rebbe even set up a fund to help people who were going to kosher kitchens and thereby incur all kinds of staggering costs that could be prohibitive, like kitchenware have to be replaced, and the koshering process is difficult. The Rebbe even set up a fund to help defray the costs of going kosher. That's how much he cared about this campaign. That's how important it was to him. So the question that I'm going to begin with tonight, and it's really just for a point of discussion, the question is, that's kind of a hard mitzvah. That's kind of a difficult challenge to somebody who doesn't keep kosher to suddenly become kosher. And in some ways, it may even be more challenging than the mitzvah of Taharat HaMashpacha, of living in accordance with the Torah. What the Torah says. Listen why. Taharat HaMashpacha affects a married couple's life during a certain portion of their life, from youth to the late Middle Ages. That's where it generally affects. At a certain point in life, it's not a monthly occurrence anymore, and then for the rest of life, your taras hamashpacha is taken care of, as long as you went to the mikveh after you reach menopause. Kosher doesn't end. It never ends. So it's from the cradle all the way down until you aren't waking up until Mashiach. It's all-encompassing. It's something that encompasses the lives of children as much as it affects the lives of adults. It's something that affects the lives of married couple as much as it affects the lives of singles. And guess what? To keep taharat ha-mashpacha properly, in fairness, the bedroom probably should have two beds. Okay, fine. Like, I grant you that. But that doesn't require a major renovation. But a kitchen which is not a kosher kitchen requires like almost like a little bit of renovation. To have one sink and keep kosher becomes very difficult. Most people want to keep kosher. If you have a little bit of space, you'd rather have two sinks. You'd rather have two separate counter areas because you can't have the same counter for milk and the same counter for meat. And I'm not a big kitchen expert, but I know that there's never enough counter space. And that's always an issue, right? So you're talking about somebody, you know, if somebody, people, a couple decides, okay, we're going to keep mikveh. What's the cost associated with the mikveh? Well, whatever it costs to go to the mikveh. You don't need to get a bank loan for that. But when people say, I want you to go kosher, so, oh, kosher, well, I was thinking of redoing the kitchen anyway, you know. So all of a sudden you're talking about major renovation, and it's not only something that affects a particular area of life. We eat three times a day. Well, some of us eat more than three times a day. People are always eating. It affects the way you go on a road trip. What are you going to eat? It affects the way you go on a business trip. What are you going to eat? It affects when you go on vacation. What are you going to eat? I mean, like every day of your life. People don't just like, well, let's take a few days off eating. This is stupid. It's costing us too much money. We're not going to eat this week, everybody. That doesn't happen. That doesn't happen. I'm not so sure. People are always intimate. There aren't times when they're on and times off. But food is a basic staple of human existence. So when you come to somebody and say, I want you to change your eating habits. I want you to change everything. From your kitchen to where you vacation, from the way you prepare food to the various eateries or restaurants that you frequent, all of a sudden, you're asking for a massive lifestyle change. And the cost is not only in going kosher, the fact is that kosher food costs significantly more money, and that's a problem. To be sure, if kosher food doesn't cost any more than regular food, one of two things is true. The food's either not kosher, or the non-kosher food is making too much profit. Why? Because to have kosher food, you require additional supervision. It's the real deal. It's a serious thing, kosher food. So there are a number of salaried people, and there's an office, and there's research. It's like another part of conglomeration of food processing. You have to pay. Somebody's got to get paid. People have to make a living. People can't do this for free. So it's natural that the kosher food is going to cost more. I'm going to give you an example of how sophisticated kosher food gets today. So this was actually a real story that happened with a rabbi who is no longer with us in Montreal. And he was a young man, and he was going to get into the city rabbinate. And they said, okay, we'd like you to go check out a certain plant. They make garlic. And you're going to go see if this is something that could become kosher. We're going to give it a kosher supervision. And he came and checked out the plant, and everything seemed fine. Today we can kosher everything, and the machines chop the garlic, and how the garlic comes in. Everything is doable. And the older rabbi who was mentoring him said, did you go over all the ingredients? Oh, yeah, yes, all the ingredients. So let's go over the ingredients together. At a certain point, they come over a particular ingredient, and he says, this is a composite. What's in this composite? The rabbi says, I don't know. So, well, we need to know what's in the composite. So it turns out that in the composite that was used for the making of this garlic powder was something called whey. Whey is a dairy byproduct. And what whey does is it enables the granules to be separated. So the rabbi says to him, so you're going to make this kosher. You're going to have a kosher sign, right? It's going to have Montreal MK or Toronto will be a COR. And then somebody's going to make themselves steak, and they're taking their kosher, their COR granules, and they're spreading it over the steak. And basically, they just had milk and meat. He said, oh, that's what it requires to be kosher. So when we're talking about kosher supervision, we need to have an office that's equipped with being able to research where raw materials come from. And we have to be able to track everything. And we have to know at all times that there isn't a change of shipment and that everything that comes in is coming from the right place. from the right destination, it's a very complicated thing. And there has to be constant supervision, and we have to check things constantly. I was once speaking to a Gentile. I met him on a plane, and we started talking about kosher. And he said, was very interested in knowing about kosher. He said, the rabbis, when they bless, do they bless the food every hour or just, and I said, no, it's just supervision. And he said, I had heard about that, he said, and I was actually thinking of going kosher. I said to him, why? It's not a mitzvah for you. He said, I'll tell you why, because there's so many horror stories about stuff coming out of China and food that's not supervised. He said, I figure if it's kosher, it's one more level of supervision. I have one less chance of getting poisoned. And he's kind of right, actually. That's not why you should keep kosher, but that would be a fringe benefit. And it was funny. And I said, you know, there's a premium. Kosher. He said, listen, it's fine. If I can know I'm safer, I'd rather be safer, which is really pretty interesting. And non-kosher food processors have been caught time and again with violations. That's not to say that everybody who has a kosher supervision is perfect, and unfortunately many people have been caught doing things wrong, but you got an extra set of eyes, or two, or three, or five, or 10, or 20 pairs of eyes that are constantly looking over somebody's shoulder. Anyway, bottom line is, kosher is going to cost more. It can't not cost more. It just can't. So you're asking somebody not only to invest in new kitchenware, not only to turn his life upside down, but he's now going to spend more money on everything. Everything is going to cost more. Kosher meat costs much more. Because it's not just a question of supervision. There's somebody called a shochet. He has to slaughter the meat. It's much more expensive to have a shochet work. Now, when you have kosher meat, certain cuts of the meat are usable and certain cuts are not. So that's a write-off. And if the animal's not kosher, that's a write-off. So the kosher company already has to take all these statistics into account if it wants to show a profit at the end of the day. And then you have a process of getting rid of the blood. And then you have a process of removing forbidden fats, trimming off the certain parts of the animal. So by the time your raw meat, forget about till they made your hot dogs or salami or your pickled beef. By the time just the raw meat comes off the line, there's a whole bunch of people who have to get paid. All these people working very hard. So how do you make a campaign out of this? Like why would they ever make a campaign out of something which is not campaign worthy? It's not quick. It's not easy. It's onerous, it's costly, it's difficult, it's a game changer in just about every which way. How do you make a campaign out of it? Why would he do so? Now, it's very interesting to note, besides the fact that the Torah talks about kashrut, as which animals are kosher, which birds are kosher, which fish are kosher, so we have animal world covered, we have the fowl, the birds covered, we have seafood covered. And if that wasn't enough, the Torah then talks about which things we're not allowed to mix, right? Milk and meat. And then, at the very end of the Torah's narrative of the Jewish people's journeys, which brings them up to the border of Eretz Yisrael, we even have verses that talk about a kosher kitchen. Or koshering a kitchen. So if you take a look in the Sefer Bamidbar, the book of Numbers, chapter 31. And the story is that the Jewish people were sent to do battle against the Midianites. The Midianites were their mortal enemies who hated them for no good reason, actually. There was no personal threat perceived towards them. In fact, the Israelites were not looking to enter their land in any way, shape, or form. And yet, the hatred that they had caused them to do the most unseemly things and to be very, very promiscuous and damage, inflict tremendous amount of disarray into their own society. And they did this because of their great hatred for Am Yisrael. So the last campaign that Moshe Rabbeinu leads is a military campaign, and it is the campaign of exacting vengeance, quote-unquote, that's the words the Torah uses, Nikmat Hashem, the vengeance of God, Me'ei Tamidyanim, from the Midianites. And then the warriors came home. And this is a very unusual battle because here, the tribe of Levi participated as well. And all the tribes participated equally. Every one of the Shvatim, every one of the tribes had to contribute 1,000 troops. And it was an even roster of 12,000 troops led by Pinchas, who was a grandson of Aaron HaKohen, who is a hero in this whole business of reversing the devastating spiritual effects and consequences of the sin that Midian caused. And they go off to war, and then they come back from war. And Moshe Rabbeinu is not happy. In fact, he's very angry at them. He says, you violated all the basic principles. You didn't do what we were supposed to do. And he deals with promiscuity, which as we talked about in the Taras HaMishpacha campaign class, That explains to us why Taharat HaMashpacha is really so important. And then the very last thing which we deal with in the Torah for the first time, because the entire fifth book of the Torah is repetition. That's just restatement of all the mitzvahs. Moshe Rabbeinu telling the Jewish people, oh, before you go into the land of Israel, you don't forget this and don't forget that. And he reviews their history and their experiences, and he reviews the mitzvahs. But this is the first time we hear about this, where Elazar HaKohen, it's actually not Moshe Rabbeinu, Elazar HaKohen is speaking to Anshe HaTzava, to the people who have just come back from war. And he says, I want to teach you the statutes of the Torah. This is the Chukat HaTorah, the statutes of the Torah, which Hashem commanded Moshe Rabbeinu. And there's, of course, a big question, if this is the commandments that Hashem gave Moshe Rabbeinu, why is Moshe Rabbeinu not the one speaking? Why would Elazar be speaking in the presence of Moshe Rabbeinu, instead of Moshe Rabbeinu could speak for himself? And there are various answers on a level of Pshuto Shel Mikra, on just a very simple understanding. Rashi tells us, quoting the Medrash, that Moshe came L'Klal Kas, Moshe Rabbeinu was angry, and because he displayed anger, every time he displayed anger, Hashem ensured that something should be confused. They shouldn't have the clarity that was mosaic. He lost the mosaic clarity. When he lost Moshe Rabbeinu clarity, Moshe Rabbeinu can't anymore teach Torah in the way that Moshe Rabbeinu can. And it was as if certain things became clouded, as if he didn't see with his natural sense of knowledge what it was, and he stepped back, and at this point, Elazar now is going to repeat the teaching that he heard from Moshe Rabbeinu. There's a very interesting Sifri, which is the Medrash Halacha that accompanies the last two books of the Torah. And the Sifri says that Moshe Rabbeinu could have regained his composure. He could have taught this law by himself. But because he didn't have his full composure, and because he felt somewhat cloudy on the level of Moshe Rabbeinu, that would be clarity we should hope for once in our lives, but for Moshe Rabbeinu that's called cloudy. Moshe Rabbeinu wanted Elazar to speak. And the reason he wanted to do this is because when Moshe Rabbeinu would pass on, the first thing when Elazar would try to assert his Kohanic authority as being high priest, they would say to him, oh, that's interesting. B'chaye Moshe, during the lifetime of our teacher Moshe, lo hayitza medaber, you were afraid to open your mouth. Achshav ata medaber, now you became a whole speaker, and now we should listen to you. So Moshe Rabbeinu wanted to show the Jewish people that Elazar was worthy. And therefore, when he's there, still alive, functioning, very much in control, he said, Elazar, I want you to teach this. I want you to be the one to convey these laws of the Torah. Clearly, these laws had to have been given to Moshe Rabbeinu much earlier. Clearly, Elazar had studied it from Moshe Rabbeinu. And if Elazar HaKohen had studied it from Moshe Rabbeinu, we have to presume that all the people had heard it from Moshe Rabbeinu. But somehow, they didn't retain the lesson. Elazar retains the lesson with perfect clarity, and therefore, this is the first time the Torah records this mitzvah. And he talks to them about the artifacts that they brought home. He says, you have gold, you have silver, you have copper, you have iron, you have lead, you have tin, you have all these different things that you brought home. Well, all these things that you brought home, they have been used with non-kosher food. And because they've been used with non-kosher food, you need to kosher them. This is really amazing. Because technically it's not a mitzvah in the Torah. There's no mitzvah in the Torah that says thou shalt kosher the plates that you buy or the pots and pans you buy from somebody. There's no mitzvah in the Torah. The mitzvah in the Torah is this is what you should eat. And that's what you shouldn't eat. Nowhere does the Torah come along and say you should kosher your kitchen. However, if you plan to eat kosher, how else would you do it without koshering the kitchen? Now one could argue that this is common sense. And maybe in today's day and age we could have figured this out, because if you're anaphylactic and you're going to have the marshmallow that's melted in the same pot that somebody just melted peanut butter or cooked peanut butter, you may go into toxic shock. So everybody understands today that metal is absorbent in as much as the naked eye doesn't see it. And when something enters into the metal walls, it's going to be afterwards just as it came in, is also going to come out. I don't know if people understood this, the principles of sterilization, 1,000 years ago. I don't know if they understood it 250 years ago. It's quite conceivable they did not understand this 3,000 years ago, or 33 centuries ago, when Elazar is speaking. But Elazar actually gives them the laws of what we would call today basic sterilization. In order to sterilize something, whatever heat opens the pores, And therefore, whatever substance it is that's being used is necessarily going to enter into that space. You have to then purge it. And the purging is done the same way it came in. This is a halachic principle which says, kebo'alo kach polto. The way it absorbed it, that's also the way it's going to spit it out. So it's the way it's going to release it. I presume that that's a basic scientific principle today, because it happens to be a fact. But whether or not we understood this scientifically or not is irrelevant. The Torah took the time, and God wanted to teach us the laws of koshering our vessels. So whether we would or would not understand, we should do the right thing. In other words, we have an actual verse in the Torah is telling us how to kosher our kitchen today. It's not an oral tradition. It's not something which was with the rabbis introduced and formalized at some point based on the tradition that they received. No, it's actual verses in the Torah. Zahav, Kesef, Nechoshes, Barzel, B'dil, Oferes. We're listing all the different kinds of metals. And it's interesting, Rav Moshe Feinstein was of the opinion that aluminum, he said, you can't kosher it. So everybody said, Rav Moshe, what are you talking about? Why can't you kosher it? He said, because it's not really metal. It's a composite made of chemicals. It's not really metal. He said, the Torah says, Zav Kesef Nechoshev. The Torah lists the different metals. And others argued very vociferously that the Torah doesn't list nickel. So nickel doesn't get kosher? They said, the Torah just gives us an array of various kinds of metals. Softer metals, harder metals, cheaper metals, precious metals, different kinds of metal. But really, if something is scientifically made of metal, then that should have the same halacha. There was a famous rabbi in Antwerp, his name was Rav Breisch. So he did all kinds of scientific experiments in koshering things like plastic and aluminum to prove that you actually could sterilize it the same way you could sterilize the regular metals that the Torah talks about. Moshe remained adamant that you couldn't kosher something unless the Torah actually mentioned it. And as a little, just like interesting tidbit, we follow Rav Moshe Feinstein's stringency when it comes to Pesach. So generally speaking, we follow the leniency, which says technically it can be purged, it can be sterilized and cleansed. But because he was a great posek, great halakhic authority in the 20th century, and because he felt very strongly about this, and remember, this is unprecedented. You couldn't cook in plastic once upon a time, and people didn't have aluminum. This is all the 20th century came along. So therefore, when it comes to Pesach, which is very stringent, we follow that stringency. And these are things which we actually wouldn't kosher. But at any rate, the Torah is very specific, and it tells us the details of how things have to be kosher or not be kosher. One of the interesting questions, by the way, that the Mefarshim ask, they say, this is not the first battle. And if it's not the first battle, it's not the first time they brought home booty. So if they brought home gold and silver before, I mean, we know about a battle against Sichon, we know again a battle against Og. So if you want to tell me that the Egyptian spoils, the Egyptians that was taken from the animals, the blood, the cavalry. So they probably didn't decorate the horse with pots and pans. Okay, fine. I get that. So, but Sichon and Og, they went in and took bowls and decanters. How come it's not discussed? So one of the answers is to the Hadar Zikanim, which is a collection from the Bali Atosvos. The answer is that all of those battles took place in the field. Rashi actually tells us that it was a miracle Hashem made that Sichon and Og lived in such fortified cities. It would have been urban warfare on steroids in the most horrific way. And it would have been such a difficult thing to capture these cities. So Hashem put it in their heads to all leave their fortifications, to leave behind their garrison, leave behind their fort, leave behind their city, and they all went out into the field. Okay, so they captured the field and they vanquished the enemy. And what did they take? They took his armor, they took whatever they decorated the animal, the cavalry with. But they didn't have pots and pans. Here they went into the cities. They went into Midian. Because they went into Midian, and because it was urban fighting, they came back with all this booty. So this is the first time that the Torah is speaking about it. At any rate, you could say that this is the first real kind of battle the Israelites had to fight. Previously, it was just totally miraculous, and the people had come out of the fortifications. Kind of a dumb thing to do, right? If you're living in amazing fortifications, why would you leave your fortifications? That's what the fortifications are built for. So this time the Midianites fortified themselves and they stayed behind the walls and they stayed behind the turrets and they stayed behind all the things that were built to protect them, but they lost the battle. When the Jewish people came into the land of Eretz Yisrael, they actually had to do those real battles. They had to capture city after city, province after province until Eretz Yisrael becomes Eretz Yisrael. And by the way, it took a long time. It took 7 years until they finished capturing, and even then they didn't capture all of the territory. So this is the first time we have a real battle. It's the first time real booty comes home. And there's this issue, this discussion, what do we do with these utensils? And the Torah takes the time to tell us that we have to kosher them. We have to cleanse them, we have to purge them, and only after it's kosher, then we talk about, the Pasuk says, Kol davar asher yavo ve'esh, taviru ve'esh, anything that comes into fire has to be passed through fire, v'toher, and then it will be purged or purified, which Rashi explains. He says, something which is used on an open spit, roasted on an open fire, well, then you're going to have to do what's called libun. You're going to have to make it red hot, what we will call today the blowtorch, or you're going to have to put it in a self-clean oven. That which is used only with water, so if it's used only with water, then we can use boiling hot water, which is basic sterilization. Let's say you sterilize the pacifier for the baby, whatever, you just pour hot water over it. So that same idea is used here as well. The Torah even tells us about rust. The Torah says, ach es hazav, and ach is lashon miut, ach excludes something. That means that there's some kind of adhesive, it has to be removed, you can't kosher that. Rust has to be removed. Stains, sometimes certain stains have to be removed. It has to be that which is only the pure metal and nothing else. According to Rabbeinu Meyuchas, it means that something like pottery, which can never be purged, it can't be koshered. It's only metal that can be koshered, but pottery can't be koshered unless it's returned to the kiln, at which point basically it breaks. It's no longer alive, and then, you know, I don't know, alive is a lousy word to use. It's no longer functional, and then it hardens again, so that's basically a new vessel. So that would be the way this is done. Another interesting thing in the nuance of these psukim, and then from there I'll try to introduce the thesis, I'll tell you where I'm going. It says that the Elazar spoke to Anshe Hatzava, Habayim La Milchama. La Milchama means to war. It should have said Meha Milchama, which means from the war. Why did he say that? So the Mefarshim say that Elazar HaKohen was talking to the Jewish people not for today, but for the future. Moshe Rabbeinu's issue with the Midianite woman and the harlots and so on and so forth, that was a one-time reality that had to be dealt with. That was not a futuristic and eternal lasting teaching. But this already is part of Yiddishkeit. This is, so it's whether you go to war or whether you simply go to a used store and buy utensils, or whether your utensils became not kosher. And anybody who has a kosher kitchen knows that that happens. So the people ask me, is so-and-so kosher? So first of all, it's a very uncomfortable question for me to answer. I said, all I can say is, if they ask questions, I say they ask shilas. They ask shilas, because it's impossible that a kitchen should function without anything ever going wrong. It's not possible, unless you have malachim in the kitchen. But if you don't have angels working for you in the kitchen, somebody's going to make a mistake at some point. So if in 15 years nobody ever had a shila, I don't know, it's either malachim there, my kitchen stuff happens, and my kids, like, how could it be? So there's got to be, questions have to come up. And when questions have to come up, what should be kosher, what shouldn't be kosher, how should it be kosher, these are everyday things that any rabbi is worth his salt is going to be dealing with. This is like the most basic questions. You have people keeping kosher, they're going to have questions. It's impossible any other way, especially you have help in the kitchen, other people doing things, they don't listen all the time. Happens all the time. Last week we had some cousins over, and my wife comes home, and my cousin says, "We're having a ball." And wife says, "Uh-huh, milk, meat, you're having a ball." They didn't know. Used the wrong utensils with the wrong things. So you kosher it, you know. And in that particular reality, actually koshering wasn't required, but that's beyond the purview of what we're talking about now. But that's what you have to ask a shayla, right? So when do you need to kosher? When do you need to just rinse? It depends what it's used with. The basic principle is, was it cooked? Cooking is the real issue. Cooking is the problem. Because the way it is absorbed into the pores is with heat. So if there's heat used, you got a problem. If there's no heat used, you generally will not have a problem. But you should always ask. All right, so what's my point? Why am I telling this all to you? I'm telling this all to you because I'm going to return to a common thesis, something which we talked about in great detail in the class about Taharat HaMishpacha, and that will be the first foundation for, I think, how we're going to understand what the Rebbe wanted with this mitzvah, how he made this into a mitzvah. So in the very same sikha, in the very same talk, where the Rebbe spoke about this idea of the journeys of the Jewish people, and that Elam Maseh, which Matot, the last, second to the last parsha of Bamidbar, is oftentimes conjoined with Parshas Maseh, which is the parsha of the journeys, that these journeys are talked about in teachings of Chassidus as being not only literal, which of course all the psukim in the Torah, every verse is to be taken literally, but also that they have to be understood in a metaphoric sense. And they are much larger than that moment, that frame in history, that 40-year frame of journeys. And on a cosmic level, from a perspective of world history or our national history, there are 42 journeys that lead us into the blessed era of Mashiach, which we hopefully are going to experience very soon. So in that case, we would look at what happened in the 42nd journey to be able to glean inspiration and guidance in our day and age. Because if Mashiach's about to come, then we're in the 42nd journey. Well, guess what happened on the 42nd journey? They got two laws. One was laws about the opposite of promiscuity and living a life of chastity and a life of purity, as we talked about with the mivtza, with the campaign that Rebbe made for Taharas HaMishpacha. And the other thing, the last thing is talked about, and it's the last novel thing really we find in the Torah, in the Chumash Bamidbar certainly, is the mitzvah of not just what's kosher, but practical, koshering your kitchen. On a practical level. So if I tell you that this bird is not kosher, or that bird is kosher, or this animal is kosher, and that animal is kosher, most of us today, well, haven't seen the animals. If we see, we saw them in a farm once, and we don't think of kosher, of, you know, cloven hooves and not cloven hooves. Very few, a lot of people don't even know what cloven hooves look like. What do we think of kosher today? I don't know. We think of it as circle COR, or circle MK, or OK, or OU, or is this a good kosher sign? Is that a good kosher? Those are the signs of kosher that we live with today. And most children, until a certain age, think that, you know, kosher food just pops up on the shelves in the store. That's kosher food. It's not so. But the first time that we ever hear about practical kashrus, and practical kashrus is a kosher kitchen, is in the 42nd journey. The 42nd journey. So it makes then sense, you know, the Rebbe and his inspired holy vision, which sees in the 42nd journey, and he says, how am I taking care of this generation? And the Rebbe spoke many times about the idea of the mitzvah campaigns. He talked about sparking the Pinta Liyid, getting that nuclear essence of Yiddishkeit, that tiny repository of faith that has unbelievable power once it's released. And that was the idea of the Mifzayim. And he also said, it's in order to ensure Imdu Hachin Kulchem, that every Yid is ready for Mashiach. Which means that every one of us is going to at least move in the direction of Yiddishkeit, is going to experience the pageantry and the glory and the mystique and the wonderment of Yiddishkeit. So in the 42nd journey, what's the last thing the Torah is telling us about? A kosher kitchen. Well, obviously then, if we're in our 42nd journey, we're at the end of the Gula, so we're going soon, whereas we talked about in the class of Taharas HaMishpacha, we're on the edge of Yarden Yerechai, which is literally on the Jordan, just opposite of the city of Jericho. But euphemistically, it could also be understood as Moreach V'Da'in, a reference to Mashiach, who, as the prophet says, will sniff and judge. So if that's where we are now, then kashrus has to be a major thrust of our generation's responsibility. So how then are you going to ensure Imdu Hachin Kulchan, that we're all ready for Mashiach? How are you going to try to get every Jew at least somewhat involved so that when Mashiach will come, we won't be entirely lost? The natural answer has to be the kosher kitchen. And that's why the Rebbe had this fund. I would presume why the Rebbe had this fund set up, that he would even help people. He would give them financial aid to have a kosher kitchen. Because this is what we need to do in order to get everybody ready for Mashiach. You're right. It's not an easy campaign. This is a difficult one from every which way you look at it. But it's absolutely necessary. So it's true, there's 613 mitzvahs. And of the 613 mitzvahs, there are easier mitzvahs, but none would be more effective or more necessary in our generation. And so, the Rebbe knew that this is something that we have to promulgate, and we have to promote, and we have to inspire and share and engage. And when something becomes a campaign, it becomes a way of life. And the truth is, if you take a look at since the Rebbe started this campaign in 1975, the proliferation of kashrus has become exponential. There are huge business events, fairs today, kosher fairs, with they're attended by tens of thousands of people. It's an enormous industry. kashrus today. The amount of kosher cookbooks that's available. If you go back 40 years ago, how many kosher cookbooks were available? And how many kosher cookbooks are available today? You can't even compare. You talk about fine dining. And we're not that great in Toronto, but you go to a place like New York City, we're like, the fine dining is unbelievable. The kosher restaurants are bringing in non-Jewish clientele because the food is so good. You know, in Israel, even in other cities like Miami, Los Angeles, I don't know, places where there's more tourists. there are many, many, many kosher restaurants today. And there are kosher hotels today. There are kosher cruises today. The whole industry has changed. And it's not inconceivable today to find people who are not what you would call, quote-unquote, Orthodox, 1,000% observant, but say, we do kashers. Keep kosher. So it's a basic, it's become a basic part of North American or South American, European Jewish life. Keep kosher. In the Holy Land of Eretz Yisrael, most of the people adhere to a basic level of kashers. And that mitzvah campaign, without a question, has been an enormous force in creating this new reality that we see today, where kashrus is front, right, and center. So this is that's really the first thing, the first suggestion. Let's take it a little bit further. If the idea of the mitzvah, of the mitzvah campaigns, was to ensure that we, the Jewish people, would have our pinta liyid, would have our nuclear essence of Yiddishkeit provoked and incited and engaged and ignited, so the question then would not be only the value of a mitzvah in and of itself, and every mitzvah has inestimable value, as the Mishnah says, nobody knows einat yodea schar shel mitzvahs, nobody knows the reward of a mitzvah, the Mefarshim, the Rishonim explain, we know that worse transgressions, bigger transgressions, smaller transgressions, because the Torah gives different kinds of consequences, but when it comes to positive mitzvahs, Torah doesn't talk about reward at all, really. So it's impossible to know, and therefore have yizor b'mitzvah kala, k'b'mitzvah chamura. We have to be very careful about a small mitzvah, in the same way we're careful about a large mitzvah. And with the Hasidic interpretation that zor means to radiate, and you can illuminate your soul with the smallest mitzvah. That's all true. However, you have to understand that there are certain mitzvahs which are going to have what we will call a global effect. They have much, much more than just that mitzvah. If it's a mitzvah that can affect the entirety of mitzvahs or the entirety of your Jewish life, and you want to make a mitzvah campaign, okay, you're a Moshe Rabbeinu of a generation, you're a tzaddik hador, and you want to make a mitzvah campaign because you feel responsible not just for your flock or the people who buy into your program, but you feel responsible to every single Jew, including the agnostic ones and the ones who hate Torah mitzvahs or think they do on the surface, but really deep down you know they have a pinta liyid, and you need to find a way to get through to them, so you're going to look at which mitzvah has a global effect. And the Rebbe said that when it comes to the mitzvah of kashrus, when it comes to watching what we eat, to eating smart, it's logical that this mitzvah has what we're going to call a global effect. When I mean global, I mean the entire picture. I'm not talking about the globe, I'm not talking international, I mean global in the sense of that it affects all of who we are as a Jew. And here's the simple idea. Everything in the material world, or the literal world, or the tangible world, or the non-tangible, but yet still physical or scientific world, all of these things will have a counterbalance, or an alter ego, in the realm of the spirit. This is a basic principle. This principle was talked about by the Rishonim, by the great medieval scholars of the Jewish people. This principle is further expounded by the early Jewish philosophers. It's a very basic principle. So, for example, when we talk about food, it's self-understood that the kind of food a person eats does not only affect somebody during mealtimes, but it affects a person's life itself. In fact, there are few details of our lifestyle that have a larger effect on the totality of our existence than the food we eat. Everybody knows this today. Everybody knows that they call it eating smart. And everybody talks about eating well. Today, in the food industry, we have the genetically modified food. You can't see with the naked eye. You can't taste the difference in taste. But people yet say that when it comes to food and it comes to digestion and it comes to the natural subatomic structure and the quantum physics of something that's meddled with, and we don't know the effects of what something is meddled with, people will be spending extra money today to buy non-genetically modified foods, which have more bugs, and are harder to clean, and they don't look as nice, by the way, because they're organic. And people are spending money on it, even though there are still, the jury is still out whether it actually is or is not healthier. The latest studies show maybe it's not even healthier. Maybe in some ways the genetically modified food might have an advantage. And I certainly have no clue of this. I can't speak authoritatively to it. But what I can say to you with absolute certainty is anybody who's somewhat intelligent and educated and informed today knows that food has a huge impact on everything. On everything. It can affect your mood. It can affect your alertness. It can affect the way you sleep. It certainly affects your weight. It affects your heart rate, your blood pressure. It affects everything. I mean, some of the latest studies out now are saying that this whole obsession with cholesterol is all wrong. They say what's killing your heart cells, is all the sugar you're eating. As I read one article, it says, imagine if you had raw skin and the skin was being constantly pummeled and constantly hurt with abrasion. At some point, you wouldn't be able to heal anymore. And the scientist claims that that's what happens when you have all these lousy sugars in your body. It's what it's actually doing to the subatomic structure of your heart muscle. I can't know if this is true or not. I mean, I probably could know if I wanted to, but that's not the point of this class. I'm just saying to you that what we know about food, as the more scientifically inclined you become, and the more knowledge we have about the body, the more we know that there is nothing more effective or nothing more impactful than the food we eat. The Rebbe says it's a logical thing. You actually ingest it. The clothes you wear can have an effect on you too. There's new technology, people putting strips of metal in clothes and claim that that creates a greater balance. Interesting that the Big Day Kahuna were made that way too. But so the clothes you wear probably do have an effect on you. And we know today that whatever substances are used in the construction, the atmosphere we live in, the environment that we're living in, whether you live with smog or you live with a smoker, we know all of this makes a difference. But food is becoming a part of you. You actually ingest it. So if you actually ingest it, and your body has to break it down, and your body has to assimilate it into your own system, you'll retain it. It's not in one ear, out the other. It stays. Yeah, the body gets rid of the payload of the basic, crass, raw material that delivers the nutrients or non-nutrients, and the body gets rid of that. But all of the energy, your body retained afterwards. So in that case, the Rebbe reasoned, it's self-understood that if the Torah comes along and says to a Jew, you should not eat this. This is bad for you. That it's not just going to be something that will affect a specific detail of your existence. It will affect everything about your Jewishness. In the same way that food on a physical, literal level affects every level of your functionality and existence, so too, eating kosher or not eating kosher is probably the single greatest factor in our healthy Jewish life. What does it mean, healthy Jewish life? The Rebbe quotes the Shelah and other of the Jewish mystics and philosophers who explain, first of all, in the Rishonim, you have Rabbeinu Bechaya and Ramban, and you have Sefer HaChinuch, that talk about when you eat predatory animals, that you acquire crass and cruel emotions, emotive qualities. You become indifferent and cruel, and that you actually, it changes your emotional structure. It changes you emotionally. And then the Rebbe quotes a Shalah that says that refined foods enable you to think more in a cleaner fashion. Or there's certain food that actually clogs your brain. It doesn't allow your cerebral activity to function in the same way. So the Rebbe reasons, well, that's basically the currency of our existence. We are intelligent and emotional creatures. We function on the level of emotions, that's our heart. We function on the level of our mind. We sometimes are very rational, and sometimes are very irrational and emotionally driven. That's who we are. That's the makeup of a human being. An animal is all emotion. There's not much intelligence. There's very little fuzzy logic there. But a human being has intelligence. So when we talk about our Jewish life, we talk about our neshama life, we're talking about A, feeling Jewish. It means we should feel good about the right things. We should feel uncomfortable with things that we're supposed to feel uncomfortable with. In order to have the proper normative sensitivity, if food affects my sensitivity or lack of sensitivity, it's self-understood that eating food that your Torah says is bad for your soul. I'm not talking about your body. But if it's bad, if there is a concept of food bad for your body, there has to be a concept of food that's bad for your soul. Because everything has a spiritual side and a physical side. So in the same way it's bad for your body, there's certain food that's bad for your soul. How would you know it's bad for your soul? In which laboratory are they going to be able to analyze a soul? None. So how do you know? You have a Torah. The Torah is telling you what's good for your neshama or bad for your neshama. And in that case, it becomes self-understood that if somebody's eating non-kosher food, A, he loses the natural sensitivity that a Jew should have. B, he can't think Jewish. There's a Yiddish way to think. A Torah way to think, a neshama way to think. And we talk about the idea of grasping a Torah concept, of being able to appreciate the profundity of a Torah idea. If somebody doesn't eat kosher, he's not grasping the Torah ideas properly. He's not feeling the proper sensitivity towards spirituality and all things Jewish. What else do you want? That is basically the structure of who you are as a Jew. So therefore, the Rebbe explained, It's something, if you want to spark the Pintel Yid, if you want to be able to drill down into the reservoir of faith that every one of us has, what more potent or powerful way than making sure there's kosher kitchens, making sure people are eating kosher. So, is it an easy mitzvah campaign? No, it's a difficult mitzvah campaign. It's not you can't do a quick jingle and say, oh, you know, it takes 2 minutes and you just splash a little water in your kitchen's kosher kitchen and then you can buy whatever you want. No, it doesn't work. It's a lifestyle change. It's huge. True. But if you want the other mitzvahs, the other mitzvah campaign, if you want the Shabbat candles to resonate and to basically catalyze change, if you want that one time putting on tefillin to be able to stir somebody's soul, what's the most powerful thing you could do to help a Jew discover himself? Get him to keep kosher. If you got him to keep kosher, it's reasonable that everything else will fall into place. And chas v'shalom, if somebody is not keeping kosher, it's equally reasonable that things won't fall into place. Here's a fascinating handwritten note that's printed here. And I'm gonna read it to you in its original Yiddish, mostly Hebrew, a little Yiddish. I'm going to translate it for you. This is actually a handwritten note. I'm reading the Rebbe's handwriting. The Rebbe writes, akoshere, a kosher, and he writes be'emet, and he underlines the word be'emet. A kosher be'emet kich. A kich is Yiddish for a kitchen. A real kosher kitchen. Okay, not kosher style. A real kosher kitchen. V'dinei taras ha'mashpacha, and the rules of taras ha'mashpacha, which we talked about in that other class. And the Rebbe writes in brackets, al yera v'al yidvayesh lomar lozeh. Don't be afraid of telling your friend about this. Kizeu al achrayusi. The Rebbe says, I take personal responsibility for this. U'bishmi. Tell it to her in my name. V'sof sof yatzliach, in the end you will be successful. So this is an answer that the Rebbe gave to a woman who he was encouraging to encourage somebody either in her family or one of her acquaintances. The yazbira, the Rebbe says, she should explain. Sheha ikir hakiyum bepoil, that the most important thing is to actually do the mitzvah. Af she'ein mevinim, even though we may not understand why this makes a difference. And the Rebbe adds in parentheses, it's not different than most medicine. We don't understand how my most medicine work, but if the expert tells us this is the pill you need to take, you'd be pretty silly to say, well, that's your opinion, doctor. You know, I understand you went to school for 15 years and you specialized for another 10. I understand, but my opinion is that's a bad pill to take. And the guy says, yeah, but you're a plumber, mister. Or you know about stocks. When I have a question about stocks, I'm going to come to you. I'm telling you, I'm a heart specialist. Doctor, I don't like the blue pill. Give me a red pill. Give me somebody that I'm comfortable with. That's ridiculous. No normal person would do that. And the Rebbe adds an amazing thing. The Rebbe says, Va'afsha omrim. And he underlines the word omrim. Omrim means, even though they're saying, She'ein ma'minim, chulu, they don't believe in anything. Ein zeh mishana ha-metzias, that doesn't change the reality. And the Rebbe adds in parentheses, She'be'emet kein ma'minim. That deep down, they really do believe. They really do believe because that's the meaning of being a Jew. You can't escape that. And that's why Jews do all kinds of inexplicable things. Because deep down they really believe. So what are we trying to do then? We're just trying to lay bare the organic essence of the neshama. And the way to do that, the Rebbe says very, very clearly, is with the concept of kashrus. The Rebbe once talked about the idea of kashrus and he said, you know, many mitzvahs are most important for somebody who's bar bat mitzvah. Because you are now tasked with the responsibility of listening to the Torah. And until you're bar mitzvah, you're not really responsible. You become responsible when you are a major. You're a minor. It's nice. It's good. It's appropriate. It's educationally sound. You're not required. But the Rebbe says kashrut has an effect, a debilitating effect on a child, even more so than an adult. Because the child's in a state of he's growing. So when the child's absorbing non-kosher food in his formative years, just like if a child eats garbage in his formative years, it's not going to bode well for his future physical health. If the child is growing up with non-kosher food, it has a debilitating effect spiritually. So therefore, what's the greatest thing we could do for our children? To make sure that even the small children are eating kosher. So this is a mitzvah that is global. It's global because it affects every single Jew, from a baby until an adult, till people are in a retirement home. It affects everybody all the time because we're always eating. So if you take one mitzvah, say, listen, I want you to keep one mitzvah. Just keep this one mitzvah. What mitzvah would it be? It might be kashrus. That might be the most powerful thing you could do. Why? Because if the whole idea of mitzvahs is to stimulate more mitzvahs, is to engage, to awake the pintel yid, what could be more effective than eating spiritually smart? Eating kosher. And you think about this, all of a sudden say, wow, this makes a heck of a lot of sense. Now, by the way, the interesting thing is that the three mitzvahs of kosher, of Tarat HaMishpacha, and of creating a Shabbat atmosphere, do you know who's responsible for those things? The Jewish woman. The Jewish woman. Now, the Rebbe used to talk about the great heroine, Chanah, the mother of Shmuel and Avi. And Chanah, he said, was also his mother's name, is an acronym for those three things. For Challah, which is kashrus, emblematic of kashrus. For Nida, which is emblematic of Tarat HaMishpacha. And finally, Hadlakat Haner, kindling of the candle. The Rebbe said, the Torah has always maintained that the eternity of the Jewish people is not vested in the hands of the men, but rather is vested in the hands of the Jewish woman. The Jewish woman always got it right. When the men made a golden calf, the Jewish woman said, this doesn't smell right. I'm not giving you my jewelry. When the Jewish men said, we don't want to go to Israel, the woman said, we'll go to Israel. They always knew what was, when it came to the foundational things of Jewishness, it was always the Jewish woman who had the clarity. By the way, you know, people say silly things like Judaism is a chauvinistic religion. Which chauvinistic religion would say such a thing? The chauvinists had to be crazy. They were like inept or mentally ill. Why would they say something, if you're chauvinist and you put women down all the time, then why would you say that all the foundational things of Judaism the women get right? In other faith systems, I use that word very loosely, that are indeed chauvinistic, they is mere there. The perspective is horrible. You wouldn't find anything like this, but Judaism is not chauvinistic. Judaism sees the role of men and women equally important and vastly different. And when it comes to the foundational principles of Yiddishkeit, the three foundation that the Jewish home is built upon, and by the way, the eternity of Judaism is not found, not in the Shul Nur Beis Medrash, but most importantly in the Jewish home. And what makes a home a Jewish home? First and foremost, a kosher kitchen, whose responsibility is the woman. that's her responsibility. It doesn't mean the husband can't cook. They tell a story. There was once a big Rosh Hashiva, a big Talmud Chacham, and he came into the kitchen and his wife did something. And he says, you know, you're not really required to be so stringent about this. She says, go out of my kitchen. I don't want you to make any problems over here. Who knows what you're going to come up with next? You know, this is a kosher kitchen. This is the way I do it. That has kept us, my dear friends. That has sustained us. That has maintained Jewish life. So that is a little bit of an understanding. There are actually most of these things he said. I'm not making this up. He explained most of this. And when you put it in the context of the 42nd journey, and you put it in the context of the words of Elazar, and you put it in the context that the only practical mitzvah, almost, that's not a mitzvah, is kosher in the kitchen, is right in there, in the last journey of the Jewish people. And you understand the purpose of the mitzvah, of the mitzvah campaign, then the question of, this is a hard one, a costly one, a difficult one, becomes moot and irrelevant, because this is a potent, powerful, and critical one. So if we keep kashrus, if we get more people to keep kashrus, it is the way to change Am Yisrael in a positive fashion from the inside out. Because we are what we eat. And when we are careful with kashrus and do what HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants and enable others around us to do the same, you can only expect the influence of the Torah and the mitzvahs to grow, to proliferate. HaKadosh Baruch Hu should help us that everybody's pintel yid, that everybody's core essence of Judaism should be aflame, that we should continue to go mechayel ol chayel, and that we should all be indu hochein kulchem, we should all be standing ready to greet Mashiach Tzidkenu, and to be ushered into Moireach V'doyen, into Eretz Yisrael HaShleima, al yedei Mashiach Tzidkenu, b'mehera, u'bi amenu amen l'chayim.